Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. We just chanted the Dhammacakka Sutta. It's obviously one of the great teachings of the Buddha. And the teaching of the Dhammacakka, the first teaching, it was enough to get Anyakondanya to become the stream winner. And obviously because the Buddha was focusing on the understanding of dukkha. And obviously somebody amongst those group of five monks really understood it, understood the nature of suffering fully. Because this is what the Buddha said, that the truth of suffering should be understood fully. Parinyayanti. Parinyayanti just means to know, but pari means thoroughly, all around. In the same way nibbana is things disappearing, but parinibbana is complete cessation. Everything finished. Absolutely, 100%, nothing left. And so the knowing it fully is such a difficult thing to do because there's a resistance there to us understanding dukkha. And so because of that, I must admit that I think it's more easy to become a stream winner by focusing more on non-self, on the source of who you think you are. And just last Saturday, at the Saturday night at the Suttas class for the novices and the Anagarikas, we were going through one of the other great suttas in the Majjhima collection, the Samaditti Sutta. And there was just a whole barrage of hints from the great monk Sariputta to the monks who were listening, again and again hammering away at the understanding of non-self, so much so that I didn't actually say at the end of that sutta that many monks were in line, but I would imagine that it's such a strong teaching which Venerable Sariputta gave, that surely that some people must have got through and become stream winners, simply because he was going through every possible part of this thing we call the body and the mind, and just showing that each one of these, it has a cause, and that cause can be abandoned. And when the cause is abandoned, the effect is abandoned. And as he went through all the different types of mental and physical phenomena, always going through using the framework of the Four Noble Truths, what it actually is, what we're talking about here. And then, sort of, where does it come from? What's its source? And once one understands this great conditionality of Buddhism, everything has a cause, you know, and it's not you, it's not a god, it's not some magic thing outside of you. This is just cause and effect, process, always working through. And when you see that these things have a cause, they have a fuel, they have a base from which they grow, the next thing is that once you take away that cause, the thing itself disappears, it vanishes. And that was a powerful teaching of causality which the Buddha applied. And he applied it just so thoroughly that there's nothing left which hasn't got a cause. At least nothing which is part of what we take to be a self, a me or a mind. Because in that Samaditti Sutta, Sariputta was just going through the dependent origination, especially going through, you know, things like consciousness and perception and feeling, and even like will with the karma formations, the sankharas. And the Buddha actually said the most important part of those sankharas, especially the karma formation, is chedana, where he said, chedanaham kamang vadami. I say that will is the most important part of karma. Will is karma, the Buddha actually said in that statement. And so when we look at every part of those, you know, links of dependent origination, we look at some of the interesting ones, the important ones. you know, your consciousness, you know, the thing which knows, your mind, the knowing, whatever you wish to call it. And the Buddha said that that is caused, not created by another being, but it has its causes from which it grows. And without those causes, there would be no consciousness left. And this is a powerful statement because a lot of people, everyone is not an Aryan, usually thinks that their consciousness, you know, is their self. They identify with the knower. And because they identify with the knower, you know, you cherish that and you won't let it go. You see that happen when you're meditating. Why is it that when you sit down, you can't let go of the itchy skin or the aching knees or the itchy nose if you have hay fever? Why can't you let go of the sounds outside you? Why can't you let go of the past and the future? Why can't you stop the restless mind? Instead of just keeping on trying to be still, you understand why? What is the cause for restlessness? Where does it come from? So remember, this is the Buddhist path, not by just trying to use your willpower or trying to sort of outwit things like restlessness. It's to understand it, and by understanding it, trace it back. Where does this come from? What generates restlessness? And of course, there's many sort of causes, but when you trace it back, it's all to do with you. The sense of self, the sense of me. Because every time that monks do get still for the first time, they get scared shitless sometimes. Things are disappearing. I always remember I think it was a teaching a retreat in Singapore once. And during the interview, someone was very, very upset. And I said, "What's going on?" I said, "I was terrified. What happened?" They were sitting down meditating and their hands disappeared. I thought it was really cute. I said, "Well, look, you're going to be really sort of scared later on, because more than just your hands are going to disappear. You know, your whole world's going to disappear. Not just your body, but your mind's going to go." But it was fascinating that there, a person, for the first time, a part of their body was beyond their reach, their perception, their feeling couldn't get down there. And that's what scared them. And this is why that we can't let things go. Because we've still got a self-identification. We think we own these things no more that we would let them disappear than a rich person would allow a thief to take their wallet. It's ours. Keep your hands off. And this is the problem. If one can penetrate a little bit to non-self, especially if you're a stream winner and you keep that understanding in mind, imagine how easy it is to let things go. When there's no owner in there, it doesn't belong to me, nothing to do with me, so you can let it go. When things have an owner, it's hard to take it away from them. When there's no owner, there's no possessor. These things just go. That's all there is to it. So when you don't own consciousness, when you don't think that's your most important possession, it means that when the consciousnesses start to fade away in meditation, when you don't hear things, you don't get at all concerned. There's not even an inclination to see what's going on outside and to alert the mind to turn on the sense of sound. It's not interested, you can let it go. Or when parts of the body fade away and you can't feel things, you don't go and think what's going on. You don't turn on the sense of touch anymore. You're quite willing to let it go, even though it means that you're going out of your comfort zone, as they say. Your usual way of experiencing the world through your senses is being taken away. But you're willing to do that because at least you have faith, at least enough understanding to know that this, yeah, it does not belong to me. What the hell am I worried about it for? If you can understand that, say, sight consciousness is not you, sound consciousness is not me, smell, taste consciousness is not me. If you understood that taste consciousness is not me, you wouldn't worry so much about eating or what you eat. Why are you worried about eating? It's nothing to do with you. It's just taste comes and taste goes. But when we own these things, this is where we make our sense of identity. We live. We exist. We are here when we're eating, when we're seeing, when we're feeling. That sensory activity gives us a sense of being. And it takes faith and also a little bit of trial and error to see what it's like to abandon being, to allow the sense consciousnesses, which what is usually defines the outer layer of being. Now the sense consciousness, the five sense consciousnesses, that's the outer layer of being. When that starts to fade away, sort of we change our whole perception of being. We're not a being which lives mostly in the world. By my living in the world doesn't mean you've got stocks and shares, or you're always wheeling and dealing and building houses and having sex and watching movies. I don't mean that's called living in the world. I mean just even as a monk, just living in the world of the five senses, seeing, feeling, worrying about what people say, talking back. Just that's nothing to do with you. That's just the sense consciousness is playing. Now the reason why I stress these things and keep on just hammering at these things, when you realize the sense consciousnesses aren't you, they're nothing to do with you, they've got their causes, they're nothing to do with you. Number one, you realize they're out of control. If they really were yours, you could control them. That's a myth, you can control these senses. Now, how many of you have spent your whole life trying to make sure you don't see ugly things, or you don't hear sort of unkind speech or harsh speech, or you don't have painful experiences in your body? You go to doctors and dentists, you take Panadol or aspirin or morphine, I don't know what people take, to try and get rid of the painful experiences of the body. You just can't do it. The reason is you can't do it because these things have their causes. You know, some of them are just nature, some of them are karmic, some of them are just fact that you're getting old. Old age, sickness and death, that's got its cause. The cause is being born. You have been born now. So you're stuffed. You're going to get sick. You're going to hurt. You're going to get pain. You're going to get old. You're going to get sort of weak. You're going to have sicknesses. You're going to die. That's what I mean by you're stuffed as soon as you get born. So when you struggle with these things, remember, accept these things more. You can't escape from them, but they're nothing to do with you. Understanding this means that we cannot be concerned with them. We can allow the senses, even aches and pains, to disappear. Sometimes you wonder when you're in pain, how can you let that one go? Sometimes people are in great pain, but how can they laugh? The answer is that they're not paying attention to it. It's not important to them. Only things which are important to you do you pay attention to. And it's fascinating. What's important for you? Now, sometimes people are watching the football on the TV, or they're watching a movie and they have these TV meals. They don't even taste the food because it's not important. The match is important. Some of them don't even know what they've eaten. How many of you can actually just say be watching the breath when you're eating instead of, so you don't even know what you've eaten in your bowl because your mind has been peaceful somewhere else? Or you've just been contemplating the Dhamma of, you know, Anicca, Dukkha, Anatta, or whatever, while you're eating. So you don't really notice the flavors of the food. The only reason you notice these things is because one thinks they're important. The only reason they're important is because it builds the sense of self. It builds identity. It builds the sense of being. But here, we're going in an opposite direction. When we understand, you know, just contemplate and get inside things like the Samadhi Sutta, or the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, or non-self. We get underneath it and really get behind what it's trying to say. That these five senses have nothing to do with you. These are sense consciousnesses. They come from a cause. They pass away from a cause. So when they pass away, so what? Big deal. when they pass away, you don't turn them on again. You can let them go. And of course, you all know what happens when the five senses disappear properly for long periods of time. That's called jhana. Vivicchehi kamehi. Being aloof, separated from, distant from, disengaged from the five sense activity. You can't feel the body. Even if you ask, well, you can't ask what's a body, but it's just those five senses are beyond the mind's reach for the period of that attainment. What's happened there? You see that these weren't me. It's great to be able to do that, because that just confirms what the Buddha said. If you haven't done that yet, if you can't let go, why? What is the cause of that attachment? Now, the cause of, you know, still being concerned with the physical body or with the sounds, or quite often with the thoughts about those sounds and those feelings and all the fantasies and dreams and the inner dialogue which goes on inside, all about the five sense realm. Where are you going to go? What are you going to do after the rains? What are you going to say to who? What's a letter you're going to write later on? That's all to do with five sense realm. So cut it. Stop it. Let it go. Understand it's not your business. Nothing to do with me. It's just cause and effect. Five senses. Nothing to do. You're seeing here that consciousness has its cause. One of the major causes of that is like interest in it. Involvement in it. It's called attachment. But remember one of the teachings which I've given a long time ago, attachment has two ends to it. It's not what you're attaching to, it's where is that attachment coming from. If attachment is like a stick which picks up things, who's on this end of the stick? Too often when we talk about attachment, oh, I'm attached to food, I'm attached to sex, I'm attached to movies, I'm attached to sleeping. Yeah, but what's attached to those things? When you look inside and see this end, you go inwards rather than outwards. You see, it's this identity business. It's me. I need to sleep. I need to read the books. I need to listen to the radio. I need to do this. It's you inside. That is the thing which is the problem. When you actually see that, you go inside and you understand that that thing which you're taking to be yourself is consciousness. You see, the five sense consciousness certainly aren't you. And the more you can contemplate that, investigate that, even think about that, realize that, the easier it is to get into deep meditation. It's not just a case of watching the breath hour after hour after hour. It's not just finding quiet places in the forest so you're not disturbed, or arranging it so it's not too hot, not too cold, so you have enough tea and just not too much, not too little, so you're sleeping off, not too much, not too little. That's not everything, as many of you know, because we have almost perfect physical conditions in this monastery during this rains retreat. It's something else. That's something else. A lot of it is your idea of self and the inability to see really deeply that those five consciousnesses have nothing to do with you. So you keep playing with them. When they're nothing to do with you, not my business, you don't play with them anymore. You can abandon them and you watch them fade away. When they fade away, that's when you understand what suffering is or what happiness is. When they fade away, the bliss of the jhanas, that is because the pain has disappeared. A lot of dukkha has gone. Of course, what you now have to do, which is really important, because a lot of people get stuck on this, to see the mind, the citta, see exactly what it is. And just like the other types of consciousness, it has its cause. And the cause of consciousness is its objects, the nama rupa. This is what the Buddha said, a simile of these two sheaves of reeds leaning against each other, the nama rupa. Now, which is basically the objects of consciousness, or just what consciousness does. Perceive, feel, and will as well. That's in attention. And these two lean up against each other. You take one away, the other one vanishes. It's not that consciousness is sometimes, you know, just there, but it's not sort of doing anything, like some dormant potential. It's gone, finished. It's not there, absent. And this is what happens when one goes through the deeper jhanas. You see parts of the sixth sense consciousness of mind vanishing. And they can vanish. You won't just get stuck in first jhana, because you know that this, even mind consciousness, is nothing to do with you. You can let it go. This is what the Buddha said very clearly in the Samaditti Sutta. This consciousness, this is what it is, the six types of consciousness. This is its cause. This is the fact that it does cease. And what is the way to the cessation of consciousness, each of the six consciousnesses? It is the Eightfold Path. So the Eightfold Path is not just the end of suffering. The Eightfold Path, very clearly said in the Samaditti Sutta, we practice the Eightfold Path for the end of consciousness. And I love saying things like that, because that stirs people up. They say, yeah, okay, I'm in it. I'm in this game, if we ending suffering. Yeah, that's, I like to do that. Even ending birth, maybe, because maybe there might be some state of neither birth nor non-birth, some sort of limbo where you can have happiness ever after, but not really being born. But when it, you say, and this is clearly from that sutta, the Eightfold Path leads to the cessation of consciousness, to the end of consciousness, then that is really laying it on the line of what this Dharma is all about. Sometimes people get really scared then. It's one thing to lose sensation in your hands and not being able to reach that sensation. But losing your consciousness, that's what they call close to the bone. But the Buddha actually said that. So that makes us sit up and understand the profundity of what this Buddha was saying. But it's not just consciousness, it's the Vedana as well. The sixth sense basis, perception. All of these things are all part, actually not perception, but Vedana is part of the dependent origination, some of the 12 links. And the Buddha said that you see these things disappearing. And if you practice the Eightfold Path, it leads to the ending, the cessation of all Vedana, the cessation of all pleasure, even mental pleasure, all pain, but also the end of all neutral feeling as well, the cessation even of equanimity. It's very clear what the goal of Buddhism is, the Parinibbana. It's not some state of bliss forevermore, where you can live happily ever after. Just like, you know, the man and woman got married and they went off into the sunset living happily ever after. And it's not just a state of equanimity forever after. Even equanimity, they say, ceases. So we're actually ceasing everything. And you think, well, yeah, that's a bit too much. Why am I doing that? And it's the point is that you start to see that you aren't losing anything. There was no one there who owned it in the first place. That whole illusion of me owning something, me doing something, me being the center of this being, which sometimes you think is the center of the universe, this me business, you're seeing so deeply that it is just a cause and effect process. There's no one in here whatsoever at all. And you're experiencing this with the clearest possible mind state you could have. And you, you bliss out. On the way to Nibbana, the more you let go, the more bliss you have. And that bliss, even though that bliss ends in Parinibbana, nevertheless, that has also an important part in this whole process. Without that, you wouldn't even get that far. Because what it does, it says, well, a lot of people say, what's the point of ending your consciousness? No, I don't want to do that. That's like, you know, suicide, spiritual suicide. But the reason you do that is not just because it's the truth. The reason you do that, the motivation, is to say if you don't do that, you suffer like hell. So, you just got a choice. You just keep on suffering, or you parinibbana. You see the truth of what the Buddha saw. And the point is, it's when you understand the Four Noble Truths and the suffering inherent in existence, and you see that also very deeply, there's no other choice but to parinibbana. The more we see this suffering business, and eventually we always see it eventually, because what happens, we have our little pieces of suffering. People we don't like, or aches in the body, pains in the teeth, difficulties living in a monastery, being bored, being frustrated because you don't get what you want in the meditation. Whatever it is causes you suffering. When that suffering manifests, that generates craving. There's a problem which is you have to do something about. And that makes you move. It makes you move from monastery to monastery, from being a monk to being a layperson, from being a layperson to being a monk, from going here and going there. What makes the world go round? Suffering. If you weren't suffering, if you're completely content, you would not need to move. Which is why the more content and happy you are, the more still you are. The jhanas, incredibly still states. And the reason is because there's so much bliss there, there's no need to move. The more you move, physically or mentally, it's a sign of how much suffering you're experiencing. You know that when you sit down and meditate. The more restless you are, it's because you're suffering. If there's no suffering, or very little, you can sit for hours. So peaceful, so still. Why? Because there's no problem, there's nothing to do. It's suffering, sort of almost like motivates the will, turns it on. Problem, let's do something about it. If one can just get rid of that suffering, will stops. There's nothing to do. There's no reason to do anything. It is suffering is the problem, and that keeps you going. And because it keeps you going from place to place, thing to thing, time to time, birth to birth, trying to find an end or find a solution. That is the meaning of life. Trying to find solutions to suffering. And there's no end to that in the world. There is only one end to suffering. It's maybe not the one that you like. It may be not sort of the one which you'd prefer. But there is no heaven realm where you can live happily ever after. Any person who really has any intelligence can know that such a heaven realm intrinsically sort of cannot exist. If you think of the most delicious food which you like, even as the best sex, after a while you get bored with it. It's just the same again and again and again. You can't have it continually. Any happiness, any pleasure is dependent on what went before it. As I think I've said before, if you look deeply, what pleasure is just a pause between moments of suffering. The reason you enjoy your food is because you weren't eating before and you won't eat after. If you're always stuffing yourself 24 hours a day continually, could you even taste food or enjoy it? This is understanding that the nature of a heaven is completely unstable, cannot occur. Whatever pleasures you have need suffering to give them perspective. So wherever can you find happiness in this world? You go to a different monastery, you go to a different place, range retreat ends, we do some work, it's end of range retreat, you go traveling, You leave here and go and get a job, find a girl, get married, divorce her, find somebody else, have kids, grow up, get a job, get rich, lose money, whatever it is. Can you see that people just go round and round? What are they doing? They're just trying to escape from suffering, and they never actually find anything. People in the world, you can look at them and ask them if they're really content. And when they answer, don't just believe them, just look and understand. Have they really found an end of suffering? Or have they just put it off for a while, have to find it later on? I don't know, I see too many people sort of dying. Too many people sick, people come with their problems. And I also see happy people too. But now those happy people, they're just a pause between moments of suffering. Just they haven't got sick yet, they haven't died yet. They're happily married, they haven't got to the divorce stage of their marriage yet. Or the argument stage. They haven't got to the depression part, the frustration, the searing anger inside. Some people have had happy childhoods, others had hell childhoods. And if you got rid of your hellish childhood, don't think you'll never get into that childhood again. Maybe next lifetime you get parents just as bad or even worse. This should be enough to make you afraid of being reborn. Just because you are smarter, you make good karma, doesn't mean you're free from suffering in the future. We've got an enormous store of bad karma from the past, enormous store of good karma from the future. One of my favorite teachings of the Buddha is a simile of the stick. When I first read that, that made me almost shiver in fear. The simile of the stick is like this. He said, just like a person throws up a stick, it's very uncertain which end of the stick will hit the ground first. Usually it's the heavier end will hit the ground first, but not always. It's the same when a person dies. You don't know whether their bad karma or their good karma will ripen at the time of their death. If the good karma ripens, you're lucky you get a good rebirth. If your bad karma ripens, you're in trouble. Even though that you try your very best and live good lives, being kind, giving, making merit, keeping precepts, being generous, and meditating, doing all those good things, even so, you still got some bad karma which hasn't come to fruition yet. You, all of you, each one of you, have another end of the stick. When you die, that end of the stick, even though it's lighter and the other end is heavy, the bad end might hit the ground first. And you get reborn in a difficult life. When I first heard that, gee, it's so uncertain, your future life. Even though that many of you are very good monks, you keep your precepts well, you're so diligent, you built monasteries, you've helped, you've taught, you've translated Dhamma. You know, this is suttas of the Buddha. It's enormous good karma. You've weighted that end of the stick, the good end, so heavily, but nevertheless, each one of you can go to hell. Either sort of a real hell, or a hellish rebirth in the human realm, or as an animal. Unless you've seen this non-self business and become a stream winner. So it's frightening. What that means is just we can't waste time. We can't mess around. The idea of just going out into the world is absolutely stupid when you realize what you are doing and what you are throwing away. The only thing to do is to get this act together. And it's not just getting into jhanas. It's not just getting still. It's actually seeing something, understanding something. Who is this person inside who's always agitating things? He's always coming and going. He's always upset. He's always frustrated. It's not frustration, trying to get rid of frustrations. Who is frustrated? Who is doing the thinking? Who is upset? Who is angry? What's the source of this? Where does it come from? You keep looking in that direction. Who feels? Who experiences pain? Who experiences pleasure? Where does all this come from? Where does will start? When I choose something, when the mind moves and reaches out for something, Where does that come from? And who's doing that reaching out? The more you examine that and use your intelligence and the stillness of the mind which you develop in meditation, even though that some of you might not think you are great meditators, still that you've restrained your senses pretty well this rains retreat, even though you think I'm exaggerating, that you will have done all very well in this rains retreat. Sometimes we judge ourselves too harshly. That's just our Western conditioning. But you have got enough stillness, enough intelligence to look. Trouble is sometimes we look in the wrong place. We look out there somewhere rather than in here. We look at what we're attached to rather than where's this end of the attaching? Who's doing this? When you look at the who's doing this, or rather what's doing this, where it comes from, look at the cause and effect. Where does consciousness come from? Where does will come from? Where does Vedana come from? Pleasure, pain come from? Where does thoughts come from? You see that they come from this wanting to be, sense of identity. Because you want to be, you want to exist, therefore you think. It's not I think, therefore I am. It's the other way around. Because you want to be, therefore you think. You move and you create this world. And what you create, it's like, it's an old myth. When you create something at first, it's very beautiful. But the thing you create turns against you and eats you and tortures you. At first, it's your slave. But then, you find it's your master. All the things which you create and crave for, all the things which you buy in the shops, which you make happen, they are like your slaves at first. But after a while, the slave turns into the master. I did a lot to build this monastery. Now, this was, if you like, my creation. But if I'm not careful, this creation of a monastery can master me. And you could worry about it and think about it all day and all night. Too often creations turn into owning you. Sometimes one goes out and finds a partner to make her mine. First of all, you think you own that, but after a while it owns you. It turns into a demon which eats you because you have no power anymore. You've lost your freedom. Be careful of creating. All creation turns against the Creator in the end. So instead of doing that, instead of wanting to be, instead we aspire for stillness, for calm, for peace. Stillness, calm and peace is when the mind becomes very even, without bumps, without problems, without suffering, without the need to generate agitation. We calm things down, we make them still. Just being calm a little bit. That's what the samana means. Shaman in Sanskrit, and that's usually the word which is most understood. But samana means the calm, the even one. Understanding that this is part and parcel of monastic life, of being even, means the agitations are what fade away. And they fade away because the craving, the desire, the will, the choosing, that also fades away. Yeah, you are dying, you're disappearing, you're vanishing. I notice in this part of my monastic life, last Tuesday I went to the Curtin Medal Awards with Oliver. I always enjoy those ceremonies to get inspiring stories about people, of how much they've served and helped in our community. But you get this recognition now as a monk. A long time ago I thought, the more you disappear, the more recognition you get. It's almost like an anomaly. The more ego you have, the more selfish, the more you want, the less recognition you have in many areas. But as a monk, the more you disappear, the more that people give you awards. Weird and strange. As if they give you a medal, but there's no place to hang it on. They pin a medal, but it just goes straight through. It does not stick, because there's nothing left there to stick onto. There's no place where you can hang those things. They start to vanish and disappear. Understanding the vanishing and disappearing, the stillness, the calm, you're getting close to anatta, to non-self. Because the more calm you are, the less you exist. The less there's a self there, the less there's a sense of being. It's scary, but it's beautiful. It's peaceful. It's nice. In fact, it's the only happiness. The more you let go of the sense of self, the more you are free from suffering in all of its form. And it's that inclination to be free from suffering which drives you deeper on this path. It may take many years or few years. You may sort of come and go from monastic life. But in the end, there must be something brings you back to end this terrible angst of suffering. It's a problem which just will not go away. You can put it off for a while, but not forever. Sooner or later, you come back and work some more to calm the mind, to still the mind, and see what happens when more things disappear. That's why that people ask you sometimes, why do all monks all wear brown robes? We wear the same so we can disappear. We have the same hairstyle so we can disappear. We don't have insignia to set one monk apart from another. If I didn't sit at the head of the line, no one knew, would know I was a boss monk. We all look exactly the same. This is why we do this to disappear. We keep quiet. We don't say things. Why do we talk? We talk to say, here I am. When we are silent, again, we disappear. We fade away into the background, so hardly anyone knows we're here. Until we don't know we're here either. Until we've gone, vanished. The more you disappear, the happier you will be. The more you vanish, the more joy you experience. The less you exist, the more bliss you feel. It tells you what the Dhamma is all about. The experience is so much more profound than all of the words. Little by little, things fade away. It's one day you'll get so still, you just end up in a second jhana. It just happens eventually. Each one of you will do this if you haven't done it previous lives or even in this life. You get so still the mind will not move. What bliss not to be bothered by this will. From those experiences, you see this so absolutely clearly. That which we call will and choice, that's the torturer. That's like these prison guards who rip out your fingernails, who whip you, who burn you. Sometimes that people look at will and they cherish it. My freedom to choose. I want to do what I want. Remember a nun. She's an American nun when I was a young monk in Thailand. The rules, especially for the women, were very, very strict. And she came to confess to me one day. She said that one day she was just so fed up with having to keep all these rules, she decided to break one. And she said she was in her hut in Wat Bapong, in the nun's quarters. She closed all her windows, she filled her glass full of water, and she drank it standing up. In Thailand, you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to sit down when you drink water. And she When she told me this, she felt so rebellious. You can see why she was doing that, because her sense of self, her ego, had been sort of so restrained. And now, here I was, an American nun, now I exist, because I decided to choose not to follow other people, but to do my own thing. If you do my own thing, then you build up your own suffering. You exist again. With that existence, you create the world, you create the suffering, you create the business. And you encourage the torturer, the will. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing to be sitting there in your cave or in your hut. You don't want anything. Or people come up and ask, is there anything I can get for you? Or if you have a genie is released from a bottle and said, sort of, Ajahn Brahm, you have 3 wishes. And you say, no thanks, not today. Imagine if that would really happen and you could actually say that. You have what I've called the freedom from desire. When desire doesn't push and pull you around. It's a beautiful state to be in. And maybe sometimes in the day, sometimes in this retreat, you've been sitting in your hut on your walking path, and you don't want to be anywhere else in the whole world. Just here, right now. What a wonderful feeling that is. Have you noticed that's a state of freedom from desire? You don't want to go anywhere. You don't need anything. Nothing's missing. A state of perfection. Their perfection is when desire is no longer generated. Doesn't need anything. Understanding that that desire, that chaitanya, that will is part of the manifestation of suffering. It is the torture. It drives you backwards and forwards, around and around. Once that desire, that craving, that will is suppressed, or rather it is just allowed to calm down. You can't suppress the will. That's the will trying to do something more. That's one of the problems where people meditate. They try and stop the will. Try and stop the thinking. Understand the very thing which is doing the stopping is what creates the thought in the first place. That very movement to do something is the cause of all the agitation. Is the cause of that which prevents stillness and peace and meditation happening. And one sees what will truly is. One can let it go. Allow it to fade. Nothing to do with me, it's a torturer. Sometimes you have to endure that, doing your duties in the world. When you have nothing to do, no duties, the more you can get away with it, the better. I know some people in this monastery think of themselves as lazy. You just don't know what laziness is. You still do things. Imagine that not just you're laying down in your room on your bed, but the mind is laying down too. Not doing anything. Not going anywhere. A mind which isn't working in the sense of creating desire and following it. A mind whose will has been silenced and stopped. If you can do that, if that happens, then you know that that type of laziness is the stillness of the mind, the jhanas, the deep jhanas, when nothing moves. It's an incredible, wonderful state where the sense of self is just 99% vanished. Wonderful thing to experience. State of such utter stillness. Lasts for hours. When nothing moves at all. Diamond, rock hard stillness. And afterwards, you understand that what was missing. The elephant in the room, as they say these days. No will was happening. The mind was free from desire. Nothing could move it. And that was a state of incredible bliss, so profound, so free. You've understood this will business is a torturer. It stops happiness and peace. And it's nothing to do with you. We assume these things to be us. As I've said, that these are the two citadels of the self-delusion. I am the one who knows. I am the one who does. And no one will stop me. This is my area, my land. Keep off. You've got freedom to do that. No one can stop you. But after a while, you'll feel that's just more and more suffering, more pain, more difficulty. After a while, there's no hope for you anymore following that path. You may just go around a little while. Once you've heard these teachings and you've come a little bit close, you don't need to even get into jhanas to experience the truth of these things. Just the closer you get, when you get a little bit still, you're sitting in your heart just watching your breath and it all gets peaceful. That's enough to tell you what's going on. Will disappeared. You feel great. Senses mostly disappeared. You feel wonderful. You get the message? Does a penny drop? It has, eventually, even though you might sort of fight against it. You're going to take that deeper sooner or later. You're going to drop more, be more still, allow more things to fade away. And you get the path of the Buddha, the path which was trodden by the Tathagata, allowing things to fade, disappear. As more things disappear, you understand you didn't own them anyway. Understand that desire was the cause of suffering. It wasn't the way out of suffering to desire more and more and more, get more, go here, go there, stop this, and control your whole world. Control is the cause of suffering, not the solution. Seeing that, one lets go of control. The ego fades. Sense of self disappears. Things become still. You vanish. Peace at last. Oh, what joy. You've understood non-self. If you truly have understood non-self, then you can call yourself stream winner. You're Aryan. You're noble one. You're on the way out. Has to happen that way. No one here. Seen it once, you'll never forget it. It will inform the whole process of your body and mind. You know that the will is nothing to do with me. It's a pain in the neck doing and choosing. Five senses, even the sixth sense, even consciousness is a pain. Why do I want to be conscious and experience this and go there and get different foods and go and see the Great Wall of China? Just what a stupid thing to do. How many walls do you need to see? If you want to see a wall, go into the wall at the front of the monastery. It's just the same type of thing, all made out of bricks, and just one is bigger than the other and longer, that's all. So what? If you want to sort of go and see a forest, just go look at the tree outside this hut, outside this hall. Just trees are trees, that's all. What's a big deal? People always think that once they go to the next trip, I often notice that there's a friend of mine, years and years and years ago, he was into drugs, and there was a time, there was a myth going around that if you put a banana peel in tin foil, then it sort of it makes LSD and then you get high. And I think a few of my friends actually tricked him. They said that this was stuff which had been in tin foil. I don't know what rubbish it was. And they gave it to him. And he said, wow, that was really good stuff. Really made me high. It just completely tricked him. There's nothing there at all. He just imagined it. In the same way everyone else imagines the joys of sex. Just you're following like sheep what other people think. Because other people say, yeah, it's amazing, it's wonderful. so too you say, yeah, it's amazing, it's wonderful. Just sheep taking their ideas of pleasure and pain just from the conditioning of our culture. I'm old enough now to remember what girls looked like when I was young. Somebody actually showed me a picture, I think it was from the book of that Indian guru some time ago. And all the girls there, you know, they were just the ones which really turned me on when I was young. And I looked at them, actually they looked really ugly and sort of yucky. Fashions have changed. I remember the picture of my grandfather when he married my grandma. You know, just, and that was supposed to be a really sexy outfit she had. Wouldn't turn anyone on these days. She'd get thrown out of nightclubs. But at that time, that probably really turned on my grandfather. It's just conditioning that sort. It's not real. It's just following what other people say and do. So be rebellious. Look for yourself, for goodness sake. What happiness truly is. What peace is. Who are you? What is this? And if you really see yourself, you're a stream winner. You're starting to see things in a completely different way than ordinary people. Ordinary people in the world, this is part of the sayings of the Buddha, it's in the suttas, what ordinary people say is happiness. The noble ones, the stream winners, they say that's suffering. They don't just say that just to be rebellious, they know that. What the ordinary people say is happiness in the world. Noble ones say is pain. What ordinary people say is pain and suffering, noble ones say is happiness. By which we mean cessation, peace, stillness. Sometimes people can't imagine what you're doing living in a monastery, getting up early, one meal a day, not being able to watch the TV, have sex, watch the footy, or watch movies. What are you doing that for? You say, because that's happiness. What you think suffering, I know, is happiness. Spending sort of fortnights, months, 3 months, 6 months in a hut by yourself, not talking to other people. That's a punishment in prison, solitary confinement. What they say is a punishment, we say is bliss. When you really understand what's going on as a stream winner, it gives you a completely different way of looking at life. The way of looking of the Buddha. It's only a matter of time. That's all it is, just time. For the whole process just to work its way through. Once you've seen there's no core in here, all the consciousnesses, all six consciousnesses, every type of consciousness, gross, subtle, far and near, the whole bloody lot, there's nothing there which you can hold and maintain as a self. The craving, the will, wanting to do things, that is just an emanation of a self and just reinforces this delusion of a self. When you still that, there's peace. It's called Sapasankara Samatha, the complete calming of the will. It's another way of describing Nibbana. That's why the Buddha said as few beings in this world would understand this complete calming of the will. But now you've got the means to understand it. When you do, you're a stream winner. And the result of that is you let go more and more and more. It's amazing. When Ajahn Chah wrote this robe, quite a few people say, oh, we thought he was a stream winner. Can't be a stream winner when he disrobes. That was almost like a Sinhalese tradition. If you're a soul winner, a stream winner, no way will you disrobe. Makes a lot of sense. Where on earth would you want to sort of go back into the world? It's only you're stupid, you're crazy, deluded. If you see what's going on, I'm not just saying this just because you are, you know, trying to make a cult. This is just Dhamma. When you see what's going on, you see that the way which leads to the cessation of suffering is the only way to live. A calm life, a peaceful life, a life of seclusion, a life of recluseship. Be reclusive. Let go of desire. Sit and do nothing. Be peace. Let go. don't attach. When you see this, you see the path is with consciousness fading. Because consciousness fades, you're in solitude a lot. Because you're in solitude a lot, there's nothing to be conscious of. There's nothing to desire. You're a one of few wishes, not demanding in nature, someone who just does hardly makes a footprint on this world. The footprint of craving and desire is not your way of walking. You're letting go, you're disappearing. And there comes a time eventually when you disappear completely. No more thinking that you are the will. Not just viewing, but complete 100% perception and thought continuous. That this is just the empty process. Because there's nothing here, there is nothing to be reborn. There is no agitation anymore. When you've cut off the seed of rebirth, this will and the attachment to consciousness, you know the seed has been destroyed. So it says in the Ratana Sutta, Kina Bija, the seed has been destroyed. How was it? Nawang Nati Sambawang. There is nothing new being created. So Ajahn Chah used to say that he didn't like creating new things. He wanted to finish off things. End things. So nothing new is being created. This is experiencing Nibbana, the ultimate release and peace. So this is what one does. So I teach like this in order to turn your minds away from the world, to condition you so that you too can actually be free and experience peace and happiness. You don't need to wander around the world looking for happiness, searching for the tortoise with a mustache. That's what it is. You can be still and you can be peaceful. You can let things go. When things vanish, you're not afraid. You're not afraid of stillness. That's why stillness comes. You're not terrified of disappearing. So at last you're free and at peace. So this is a way to end suffering, to understand the non-self, letting go of things. So hopefully you've got 2 weeks left, plenty of time. So may you all become arahats before the end of the Rage Retreat. Very good.
Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Sangha.